Side A, and at this particular point, we had just finished discussing this depressing period, as you mentioned it. I was just curious. Obviously, there was a money problem with the company at the time. Was that, this was in the early 60s?
In the early 60s.
And I'm trying to think of what would have made the oil industry...
I don't really remember specifically, but, you know, over the years, there have been times when it's been very easy to get money within the company, and there have been times when it's been very hard. There have been periodic... sharp cutbacks in that often took place in all departments, R&D as well as manufacturing and everything else.
Mm-hmm.
And all I'd say is that this was one of them.
Yeah.
And this one hit R&D particularly heavily.
Okay, so it was just part of the normal ebb and flow of the industrial environment, and you were really hard hit by this one.
I think that's right.
Well, I think we've covered a lot of territory. I would like basically to kind of maybe hit some of these questions that or areas that we have outlined here. What would you? You've worked in this area for many years and have done quite a bit of important fundamental work. What would you characterize as the single most, or what do you think of as the capstone or the highlight of your career of research in this area?
I don't really know any one answer to that. There are quite a number of the pieces of work that I had a hand in that I think back to with real pleasure. From time to time, in looking for some reprint, I will page through a number of them, and I find quite a number that I'm really very pleased with, even years afterward. Certainly, the one publication we have that attracted the most attention was Tropilium.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think there's any question about that.
Mm-hmm.
And in connection with that, I might add just one little item. Our original tropilium work was done with strictly deuterium tracing. But subsequently, we took our first stab at using a carbon 13 tracer there, in which we labeled toluene with a carbon 13 in the alpha position.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if our picture was right, if after the loss of the first hydrogen, the C7H7 ion that's left attains complete symmetry, so that the various carbons can't be told apart,
mm-hmm.
and if then two carbons are broken out at random from this seven-carbon chunk of stuff, and you're left with five, then if you have one tagged atom in the C7H7, the C5H5 should be 5/7 labeled,
mm-hmm.
or 71%.
Mm-hmm.
I remember when I got that spectrum out and calculated the label retention in C5H5 and got on the telephone and told Paul Roilander that the experimental figure was 69%.
Mm-hmm.
And Paul's response was, "Ain't it grand when nature's on your side?"
Yeah, that's...
Now, there is another item that comes to mind that doesn't really have any much to do with organic chemistry, and I don't think that very many people even who have followed a lot of my work are especially conscious of it, but I think it's also in about 61, a lot of things happened in 61, I think, that I was doing some work with some deuterium label. This was work with Ernest Eliel, as I recall, working with some deuterium-labeled chlorine compound. And when you collect the data on the fragment ions and go to calculate the label retention, you have to first calculate out the natural abundance, of course, of all the atoms that are there, and that included the chlorine, and I was getting consistently inconsistent results. And after this had happened with some three or four different compounds, I began to suspect that maybe there had to be something wrong with either what the machine was doing or with the data in all the established tables of isotopic distributions. And so I pulled down about maybe a dozen different chlorine-containing organic compounds from our shelf, measured their spectra on our 21-103, and then calculated out the contributions of heavy carbon and calculated what the isotopic distribution of the chlorine atoms would have to be if it were going to be consistent with our data. There was a difference between the number that came there out of that, which did not have a lot of spread. I had a lot of data on several different compounds and over a wide mass range on several different ions. And the average figure there differed by several tenths of a percent from the then accepted value from most of the published tables of the chlorine atoms. Well, I wrote up my finding and I drafted something that I considered as a kind of a letter to the editor, and I sent it to several people for comment first, including Al Neer. Now, this was particularly pointed first because he has had such a large part in establishing the isotopic distributions of isotopes in nature, and secondly, because the then accepted distribution of the chlorine isotopes had been determined by him years earlier. The value that I had come up with differed, as I say, by several tenths of a percent from his, and it agreed with another value that had been determined by some people at a nuclear research laboratory in Canada several years ago, and had appeared in some of the older tables, but apparently been discarded in favor of NEER's newer results, which were considered better. I had some fascinating responses. Neer said, "This sounds great. Publish it." The fellow from Canada, Chalk River, is that the name of the laboratory?
That sounds familiar. I believe there is a Chalk River facility.
He wrote me a long letter. It was longer than my proposed letter to the editor, in which he filled me in on all the possible sources of error. And it was a very discouraging thing to read, believe me. But he was being very cautious and was certainly not arguing in favor of my data, even though they were in accord with his published data of some years earlier. In any case,
that Neer, whose numbers you were disputing, said, "Yeah, that looks like..."
He said it looks like good, careful work. Publish it.
But the fellow whose numbers you were supporting said, "Well, you know, here's all these problems that you could be having." I see.
That's correct. Well, I submitted the letter to Analytical Chemistry, and it was published early in 1961. Later that same year, maybe 6 months later, the National Bureau of Standards published a redetermination of the natural abundance of chlorine isotopes, which had been a very, very careful, demanding piece of work, in which they had first separated the isotopes and obtained each one in something awfully close to 100% isotopic purity. And then after that, proceeded to try to take into account the instrumental discrimination effects on both of them. And the numbers that they came up with agreed with mine to about 2 decimal places, which was fantastic. They cited my letter, and I appreciated that. Well, at least one fellow at our laboratories, this guy is a chemical engineer, years later reminded me of that piece of work, and he has done so repeatedly, and I have heard him refer to it on a number of occasions in the presence, in open meetings of one kind or another, at our laboratories, in which there was some question about some discrepancy or some piece of data, and in which essentially what he said was this. He said, we've got at least one guy on our staff who, after making measurements, the best measurements he can, finds that they are not in accord with the measurements in the accepted tables of data, has enough confidence in his own work to challenge the published data. And then he describes what I did there. And I remember the first time that I heard him say that in an open meeting. I'm not sure whether I'd ever even met him personally at that time. But believe me, it gave me a lift.
Well, sure. Well, I mean, it has to, because you know, it shows that you are definitely in command of the equipment and of the interpretation of the results, and well, you're also minding your scientific P's and Q's and not running off with a piece of half-cooked information. Right?
Yeah. Now, I think, you know, if you ask me for sources, you know, what kinds of things I've done that have given me a great deal of satisfaction, I think I was fortunate in that I learned a lesson very, very early. That I learned not to be, ever to be the least bit concerned if someone wants to challenge our interpretations of the data. But to do my darndest to be sure that the experimental data that I publish are trustworthy. I don't know of any instance of any experimental data we've ever published that were demonstrated to be wrong by somebody later. A great many of the measurements that we've published have been repeated by other people, and often with very much more sophisticated and complex and elaborate equipment. To the best of my knowledge, our published data has always held up, and I think I have a bias in favor of trying to do the work by the simplest procedure and with the simplest equipment possible. Now, I take a lot of, I have always taken a lot of encouragement from good agreement between actually both experimental data and interpretations that we have published over the years, and the experimental data and interpretations that have followed over many years by many measurements by very competent people with much more elaborate and sophisticated equipment than anything that we use. I find that highly satisfying.
Well, it's the sign of a good, thorough, and professional scientific career, and that's, you know, I mean, it's definitely what we're in this business for, is to do the best we can, and when it can stand the test of time, and the rest of the published work that comes after it, then, you know, I mean, it's got to be a gratifying thing. What do you feel? I'd like to kind of switch over to maybe talking about instrumentation for a while, and in terms of developments. Clearly, as you've already indicated before, when you first got involved in mass spectrometry, we're talking about it, essentially you were doing an unregulated, you had to be the feedback circuit for regulating the track current in the beginning. A lot of the
again, we learned early that even though we were nominally carrying out chemistry triggered by electron impact, in fact, we learned early that there are other things that get involved also, that with all the care in the world, we could never completely rule out contributions of simply thermal reactions. They're always, temperature always has an effect, makes a difference.
Yeah.
At the very beginning in particular, there was an enormous contribution of bimolecular reactions that took years of engineering development to minimize.
This via better vacuum systems?
Of course, of course. Now, since then, bimolecular processes have been developed, but in a somewhat different, have become an important part of mass spectrometry, but in a system which they're under some control.
Right.
And they can be extremely helpful. Field ionization and field desorption have opened up techniques, given us access to materials that we simply had no way of working with otherwise. We learned early in the game that in a field ionization experiment, there is always a chance, there's always likely to be some contribution of field desorption. And on the contrary, in field desorption, there is often, I am convinced, a contribution of field ionization. Mm-hmm. Of materials that we have historically not regarded as volatile, but that have enough vapor pressure under the condition in which we operate, so there is a field ionization component. There is simply no such thing as anything that is absolutely, unequivocally pure and unadulterated in chemistry. Now, you know, for the first many years of mass spectrometry, we tried very hard to interpret our mass spectra on the assumption that all the fragments we observed arose by single steps, breaking of one or two bonds in the original molecular ion. Mm-hmm. It was a long time before we came to recognize that there may be much more going on, that there are reorganizations, rearrangements that may interfere, that there are stepwise processes. Quite a number of years ago, in one piece of work that we published, I think on trinitrobenzene, using traditional, conventional metastable peaks, we demonstrated a long string of processes that went through as many as four and five successive events. Mm. And this is typical, not atypical. So that we have tried to interpret our data on the assumption of a level of simplicity greater than anything existing anywhere in chemistry. Maybe in part, this is naivete that we inherited from the history of our instruments, which after all were primarily, originally, developed by physicists. Not very much input from chemists. Mm-hmm. We accepted what they told us and went on from there. A number of the early publications point to the appearance of a C2H5 ion in the mass spectrum of isobutane as an enormous mystery. Looking back on it, it's hard to imagine how a chemist, with or without any direct experience of mass spectrometry could regard that as that complicated, you know, mm-hmm. and as that mysterious. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You can dream up several possible scenarios leading to it, and whatever you decide to accept or not accept, you know, it's not pretty terribly important. Mm-hmm. I can recall being asked in all seriousness by a physical organic chemist of world stature if it's safe to assume that all ions having the same elemental composition have the same structure. Mm-hmm. Today that seems wild and ridiculous. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Quite early in the game, a number of people, and I guess Dave Stevenson and his associates were particularly prominent in this area, started to make appearance potential measurements and to develop numerical thermochemical data from such measurements on the basis of some assumptions as to what was involved. And somewhere along the line, it very gradually, and believe me, it was gradual, very gradually, began to realize that there's something that is less than obvious in this whole picture, where people found products that could not be produced simply by breaking one or two bonds in the original structure. They had to be result from a rearrangement of some kind. The common usually implicit assumption was that there is some extra energy involved in this thing. And somewhere along the line, if we can figure out how to measure it, we'll find that extra energy. Mm-hmm. As time went on, we began to realize that many of these rearrangements, or at least, occur because they allow the saving of energy. They occur because they take less energy than simply breaking a bond. In one of our early papers, we were led to point this out and say that we are forced to conclude at this point that that the process leading to a product involving molecular rearrangement is likely to have required either more energy or less energy or the same energy as a product that does not involve rearrangement. And that's about all you can say if you insist on generalizing. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Again, at an early stage, and it must have been sometime in the late 50s, I remember speaking before a seminar at Purdue University, where Frank Field had taught fairly recently, maybe a month or so before me, and where people were quite shocked to hear me express any reservations about the values of bond association energies derived from appearance potential measurements. This kind of shock was widespread in the literature at that time too. I think that mass spectrometrists, whatever their own reservations might have been, by and large, had succeeded in snowing people concerned with thermochemistry, who felt that they knew so little of what was involved in mass spectrometry, they were not prepared to question or challenge mm-hmm. the numbers. It was almost, you know, people were, they simply were taken aback to hear anybody express any hesitation mm-hmm. about taking those numbers at face value. Now, I guess one other piece of work that maybe is worth mentioning now is some work that I did with Fausto Ramirez not too many years ago on the enzymatic hydrolysis, or non-enzymatic hydrolysis, of phosphate esters, in which we try to clarify as well as we could the role of PO3 minus, the monomeric metaphosphate anion.
Mm-hmm.
Found that a very satisfying piece of work. We did 018 labeling on that, and I think that we came out of it with about as clear-cut a picture as one can reasonably hope for, mm-hmm. at least for the foreseeable future.
So this is getting a little bit away, I guess, well, away from the petroleum or petrochemical aspects of the applications. It'd be more in a, well, as you pointed out earlier, organophosphorus chemistry, which is quite a bit different, I'm sure, than, of course, with the tools.
Yes, but you know, the saying is trite, but the kinds of things that I've gotten into have reminded me innumerable times that everything is related to everything. And a very large number of the exploratory pieces of work that I had gotten into over the years, often just because some compounds were available to me that made it possible. Great many of those gave me insights and led me to write mechanisms and draw conclusions that turned out to be helpful in attacking analytical problems mm-hmm. and mechanism problems that came to me from people in our research and development, from people out in the field, in manufacturing, marketing, throughout the company over the years since then.
Mm-hmm.
So in addition to that, there's a whole family of organophosphorus compounds that are utilized as additives in both polymers mm-hmm. and petroleum products, so that I never felt any hesitation in putting time and effort into trying to understand whatever I could learn of phosphorus chemistry. I didn't feel I had to explain it or apologize to anybody in the company, and nobody ever challenged it.
The computer has had a big impact on mass spectrometry. Would you care to comment on how you perceive the impact? And I mean, we did this at one time earlier, discuss the fact that computations were essentially done by hand. For gas analysis. What do you think about computers and mass spectrometry?
Well, years ago, when computers were still fairly new in our organization, over a period of a few years, I took two or three courses in computing
mm-hmm.
techniques. And there wasn't anything terribly difficult or complicated about them, but there was nothing that ever grabbed me either, and I never felt any great need for using these techniques in the kinds of things that I got into,
mm-hmm.
so that I have never really established rapport with computers.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, I have learned well that computers hooked up to mass spectrometers can give us a huge amount of first-rate data in very little time. And much of those data would simply not be accessible by any means without computers.
Mm-hmm.
And I have been perfectly happy to take advantage of all of that. Fortunately, there have been several people in our mass spec group there in Naperville who have had good rapport with computers and who were prepared to make the measurements that I wanted. And so I've had the benefit
mm-hmm.
of their efforts and have taken advantage of the data with no hesitation at all. But I have not talked to the computers myself, and I do not own a personal computer. My wife recently bought a word processor
mm-hmm.
and her intent was that it was for both of us to use, but I've stayed as far away from it as I can. I use my little portable Hermes non-electric typewriter for any correspondence or any typing, anything that I need to get down. Lottie uses her word processor, and it just has made a world of difference to her. Mm-hmm. So
basically, you feel that you're a beneficiary of computers and mass spectrometry, but that's as far as you want to go with the whole. Yeah. You didn't really apply them in any of your fundamental studies or anything like that.
No. I use the data.
Yeah, sure.
But now, for years, our for the most part, the quantitative analysis done at the mass spec lab there in Naperville, and a lot of the qualitative analysis of unknown mixtures of various kinds has been computerized to the point where the data are fed from the mass spectrometer directly into the computer, and it carries out essentially all the operations and types up the report. Mm-hmm. Somebody has to look it over to be sure that nothing has gone drastically wrong, mm-hmm. but that's all right. On the other hand, the kinds of problems that I've been engaged in, we don't understand the chemistry well enough to be able to tell a computer mm-hmm. how to do it. Mm-hmm. And so this is something, these are things that I puzzled over and scratched my head over, but I did make use of lots and lots of data mm-hmm. that came out of computers.
ASMS has been around for a while in various forms, at least a meeting of mass spectroscopists, starting out, I guess, with the early vendors in ASTM and then ASMS. What can you single out some things that you've noticed in the evolution of the meeting from its inception, other than clearly it's essentially sponsored by different people, and it's gotten larger. But the flavor of the meeting, or what do you have any feelings or observations over those years of how it's evolved, the meeting and its attendees?
Well, first remember that 7 years have passed since the last ASMS conference I attended, mm-hmm. and I don't know what's happened since then. I've received the proceedings, and I appreciate having them, mm-hmm. but I haven't been to any of the conferences. certainly, the number of people attending, the size of the meeting has increased tremendously. The number of simultaneous sessions has increased a great deal. There was a huge struggle before we went from just one single session to two simultaneous sessions, mm-hmm. and another big struggle when we introduced a third simultaneous session and a fourth, and I don't know whether it's going beyond that or not since then. I have, the moment simultaneous sessions came on the scene, I started to find myself with conflicts, and I have always found myself with conflicts of that kind at ASMS conferences. Mm-hmm. The papers, if I go to a meeting and I have a dozen papers that I want to hear, the chances are very good that they will be given at only four or five or six different times, and there will be two or three different papers given simultaneously in different places that I would like to get in. Mm-hmm. And it can't be done.
I
don't know how, it's the same thing has happened at ACS meetings, of course.
Sure.
And I don't know any answer to that. Certainly, we started out as an organization of analytical chemists. Some of us were heavily into instrumentation, and others were heavily into trying to get and interpret the data, and some of us had a hand in both fields. But first, when academic people came in, a larger part of these conferences started to be devoted to considerations that seemed more and more arcane to analytical chemists who were concerned with day-to-day problems very mundane problems. And over the last several years, a large part of the emphasis at this conference, as a large part of the emphasis in the journals, has been on biological problems,
yeah.
In which the mass spectrometry is almost incidental. And I don't know any way around it either. Those biological problems are important, and I'm pleased that to see the field in which I was able to make some contributions over a number of years, itself in turn able to contribute to the solution of biological problems. At the same time, I look at the proceedings of an ASMS conference these days, and I found a great many papers that are written in a language that I simply don't understand. And I have to hunt for the ones that I want. Mm-hmm. Furthermore, as the generations have come and gone, I find that a great many of the people doing mass spectrometry today are share characteristics that I have encountered over the years among many younger chemists. I've had the privilege and the pleasure of refereeing lots and lots of papers for the journals over many years, and particularly in papers that have come to me for refereeing, I have often found younger people, often while they're still doing their graduate work, sometimes just after they've completed their graduate work and they've just started their professional careers, write papers that in effect said that this field has been just a huge, chaotic area with no order to it, but now I have arrived and I'm going to bring order out of it. So pay close attention.
Mm-hmm.
And with that in mind, they themselves ignore great bulk of the work that was done before they arrived, and ignore almost completely anything that's more than 5 years old.
Mm-hmm.
It just can't be worthwhile.
Mm-hmm.
Now, particularly in work with Ellis Fields, because he and I have looked at these things in much the same light, we have taken great pleasure in papers that we have published in chasing down pertinent work and calling attention to it that was sometimes more than a century old.
Oh, my.
And we have, I think both of us have just felt that that's just great.
Yeah.
we can't always do that, and they're not always easy to find.
Mm-hmm.
Now, even when a number of years ago at the Washington meeting of ASMS, when a couple of people put together an exhibit on the development of mass spectrometry.
Yes.
And in that exhibit, you recall, they describe this unpublished spectrum of Almir's of benzene as the first intentional mass spectrum of an organic compound. They weren't too far off, but they were off, because that came about 1935 or thereabouts, and I've chased down a fair number of such spectra going back to 1928.
Yeah,
I'm not prepared to swear that there were none before 1928.
Yeah, those were the ones that you mentioned earlier.
Yes.
Yeah. That was news to me, because I obviously haven't dug back that far in the literature, but it's good that someone's looking back there.
Yeah, it's kind of fun
mm-hmm.
to find what people were thinking about mm-hmm. and doing back then, and to find, on the one hand, in the first many years of mass spectrometry, and I suppose the same thing can be said of a lot of other fields of chemistry and of other sciences, on the one hand, we tried awfully hard to interpret our data in terms of some tremendously oversimplified models, and at the same time, right along with them, people working in our areas exhibited some marvelous insights. These were all happening together.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes the same people.
Yeah. You know, the point that you mentioned about, I guess what you, for want of a better word or phrase, you call ignorance of the literature, came home to me yesterday at the, when I was attending a Pittsburgh conference and a session on paralysis, and the speaker essentially discussed the fundamental mechanism of paralysis and polymethylmethacrylate.
Of what?
Polymethylmethacrylate.
Yeah.
And one of the people in the audience took him to task in the question and answer session, indicating, you know, that this work had been done before and it was in the literature and the mechanism had already been published. And it was, you know, although he was very kind about it, I mean, he wasn't nasty about it, but he really was saying that, you know, the guy doesn't really have to discuss that in his presentation. He could have discussed the other parts of it and just, you know, referred to the fact that prior work had been done. So I don't know if there's any way that the issue can ever be dealt with, the fact that people don't take enough care in looking at the literature. I guess it's a measure of professionalism, and that's about a reflection.
Well, it comes out in various ways. On the one hand, over the last year or 2 years, 3 years, I have caught several instances in the literature in which people have dealt with things that my associates and I have published on, and obviously are totally unaware of. In one case, the guy found a breakdown pattern that struck him as quite extraordinary and unprecedented, and he proceeded to not only report it and to use these adjectives to describe it, but to offer a possible mechanism to account for it. And it's a system that we first published on in 1956 and have dealt with repeatedly since then, have elaborated on, and in which I did a review paper on it in 1989, bringing it all up to date. This guy's speculation is just simply wrong. And, you know, we knew it. I was annoyed when I wrote to him and he acknowledged that, yes, he missed it all. I felt that he should have published a correction to his paper. But obviously he didn't feel it. That was called for.
Yeah.
Now, in a kind of a different sense, I find that more often than not, for the last umpteen years, when there is a reference in the mass spectral literature to tropillium, nobody bothers to identify the source anymore, because this is something that everybody knows. It's simply become, you know, part of the established knowledge. It's taken for granted.
Yeah.
So it doesn't make any difference anymore. Nobody's concerned with where it came from. In a way, it's a great compliment. I don't know. I guess I've got kind of mixed feelings.
Yeah,
about that one.
I can understand. It's a fundamental contribution, and it's like probably the kind of thing that happens when a brand name becomes a household word, like Kleenex.
Yes.
Or you know, that type of thing.
Victrola.
Yeah, and people just, you know, accept that as being definitive, and that's enough, and it's all well understood by everyone.
Yeah.
So, yeah, like you say, it's kind of a compliment in a way. Certainly, what it shows definitely is the overall acceptance of what at the time, when it was originally proposed, was a very difficult concept, in which, obviously, as you pointed out before, Brown
had difficulty with it, but he couldn't come up with anything better. And so the fact that it has become accepted is somewhat satisfying in its own right.
I remember the first time that we talked about Tropilium to a group outside of our company was in our little Midwest spectroscopic group that was centered around the Chicago area. And in a one-day meeting at our laboratory, I presented that work. First time talked to anybody else in our company and those two consultants. And John Kinder, who worked for Sinclair, perhaps you remember him.
The name sounds familiar, yeah.
Well, he certainly was, he was the lead man in their mass spectrometry operation for years. He was quite upset by it. And he said, "Do you realize what you're saying?" He said, "If what you're saying is right, we can't believe anything the mass spectrometer tells us anymore."
Well, not anything, but well, the issue really goes back to the fact that an ion is different than a neutral. Some of the chemistry may be the same, but it's not all guaranteed to be the same.
Yeah, and even behind that, we're dealing with chemistry. Chemistry is often much more complex than simply breaking one or two bonds in an original structure.
Well, do you have any other areas that you want to cover? I've kind of covered pretty much the things I was interested in our outline. I don't know if there's...
Let's see, I had that other...
Oh, yeah. I don't know if that's here. Maybe that's probably got in your folder, the one where we had the...
I think there's just another copy of your outline that... Must be around somewhere.
Yeah, it wouldn't be in here because most of this stuff clips in here, I don't think.
Yeah. There's nothing just shoved in there, is there?
We can try this.
No. I don't know. There's a stuff here. Yeah, this one.
I don't know if you would care to comment on any of the individuals that you've known over the years in mass spectrometry in different parts of the country or the world. Obviously, you've had a lot of interaction, and we've talked about a number of those individuals. I'm always reminded of this little anecdote about Frank Field, and I guess... fellow of Delaware now, Burnaby Munson, when they published their original work on chemical ionization, the reviewer really took them to task and essentially, kind of, I guess it was a very much similar thing to the incredulousness with which the tropilium ion was granted.
Similar to what?
The incredulous aspect of the tropilium ion, and this guy, the reviewer, recommended that the work not be published because it just didn't make any sense. It was all wrong and everything. And when they first started in chemical ionization, the first publication that detailed the concept of chemical ionization. You've known Frank. Did you meet him at the mass spec conferences? No, he did work. He worked for Humble, was it?
He worked for Humble. I met him at the group meeting sponsored by Consolidated.
Yeah.
Very early in the game. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I don't think Frank was especially happy with tropilium either at first. Mm-hmm. I can't remember very clearly anymore, but I have a vague kind of recollection of that. One of the most, one of the